Good evening, a broad and handsome welcome to Saturday Night Fry. Nestling around the green bays with me in the studio tonight, actor and chameleon John Sessions. Rupert Murdoch, Professor of Language and Communication at the University of Oxford, Jean Aitchison. Singer, songwriter, actor Ian Dury. Artist and restaurateur Damien Hirst. Musician and composer Richard Coles. Poet and novelist Ian Sinclair. And as the mighty Wurlitzer of Roy Wooten and Bob Barrett fades away, it's my pleasure to bear you company for the next 45 minutes or so. I was in Scotland the other week. It doesn't matter why. It's really none of your business. Let's just say I had things to do, people to see, sausages to prick and capons to baste. The point is this. I found myself in my hotel room in Dundee, spitting and snarling and shuddering with rage. Real hot rage. Hot and red. Why? What moral outrage, what howling injustice, what terrible wickedness or pain had been let loose there in Dundee, city of jute, that could have driven all sense, splendour and serenity from me. Well, you may have spotted that as I introduced Damien Hirst here, I used the word restaurateur. In my small but revoltingly appointed hotel room there in Dundee, the television happened to be on as I was quietly toweling myself off. A news story emerged in connection with restaurants. I can't remember the burden or thrust of the news story, and perhaps that's the point. All I can remember is my horror as the journalist in question used the word restaurateur. And then my overpowering fury as I saw the word restaurateur printed up as a caption over an interview with a chef proprietor. It's a common enough error, it just happens that the word restaurateur doesn't exist. There is no N in restaurateur. To see this misspelled word actually written up in captioned form on a BBC news programme made me livid. Then I grew more livid with myself. What business had I to be angry about something so pettifogging, so greasily pedantic? I'd missed the story myself, which, for all I knew, was about the death of children or the threat of war, subjects infinitely more important than linguistic solecism. So easy to feel that standards are collapsing all about us, that we've never lived in an age in which people care so little about their ignorance. But is my knowledge the other man's ignorance? The other man's knowledge, my ignorance. It's something I thought we could talk about later. First, just like to ask around the table, quick snapshot. Irrational fury of the kind I felt at restaurateur. Have any of you had a similar moment lately? John, I'm going to start with you, John Sessions.
Different than is always a very bad one for me. Infradig as an expression is repulsive. Fine words butter no parsnips. I could go on and won't.
All right. Well, Ian Dury, what about you? Do you get angry about these sort of things?
I remain in blissful ignorance.
What about you, Richard?
Oh, overcooked pasta for me. Every time. Oh, and men whose hearts are filled with hate.
That's a very unusual one. I like it. Yeah. I like it. Ian Sinclair?
Any names? No, I get uneasy when people throw it at me. You know, I kind of realise that probably something I've just written is full of these, and I kind of go back with shuddering horror, and the whole thing of picking up on these mistakes. The mistakes are the territories I live in. I love the mistakes.
Yes, and we're here in Radio 4, which is, of course, the territory of the language pedant, of course. Damon, does anything make you angry like that?
Not really angry. I get annoyed. I got annoyed with the Royal Pharmaceutical Society when they said I had to change the name of my restaurant from pharmacy.
Yes, that was a legal problem.
Annoyed, though, but I kind of quite like it.
Gene Aitchison, you actually did a whole brief lecture on the subject of language, and I think you made it fairly clear that you don't worry about pedantry.
No, what annoys me is people who do worry about irrelevances, especially linguistic trivia, which don't matter. Clarity matters.
Now, listen, we're going to come back to this a little bit later, but the word clarity makes me think of red wine stains, and red wine stains makes me think of Damien Hirst. Now, a small area in this cathedral of a wireless programme, which I hope will develop into a much-visited side chapel, will be a space in which I have an opportunity to talk to people about work in progress. We often hear from artists, writers, musicians and so forth who have works currently opening or being published. I thought it would be fun to talk to such people about work in progress, pieces that may never see the light of day, but which are currently preoccupying them. It's an especial pleasure to talk about such things to a man impossible to introduce without resort to tedious Frenchery, Bête Noire, enfant terrible, succès fou, and folie de grandeur. I'm talking, of course, about Damien Hirst. Damien, if I were an artist, I would no more like to talk about my work than as a writer I would like to appear on television and do a painting of my latest novel. Words and pictures don't always mix very well. Do you resent the common British attitude that a modern visual work has to be explained in words?
I mean, I don't think it does. I mean, you know, there's a visual language, there's an infinite number of ways to get to the same point. But, you know, I mean, advertising uses... What?
You just, I hope, proved my point in a kind of verbal sculpture.
I was trying to escape you visually, but it doesn't work on the radio, does it?
Absolutely. But there are, of course, millions of people out there who believe somehow, or at least who give the impression that they believe, that, particularly with modern art, that unless it can be expressed as a kind of, almost like a crossword puzzle, given as a key verbally, then it is somehow meaningless.
I don't believe that.
You don't think there are people who think that?
No, I don't believe that. I mean, I think advertising uses visual imagery to sell products to people, which is, you know, the whole thing. Edvard Munch painted The Scream, and it's just paint on a canvas, and the thing is you can hear it, you know what I mean? It's like, if you look at it, you can hear it, and everyone gets, like, wrapped up in that. I don't know, you know.
Mm.
I love art, me.
Yes. Now, as far as work in progress is concerned, we were talking a little earlier, and it seems that you actually have some work in progress, which is called Work in Progress, which is a rather eerie coincidence.
I have an idea for an exhibition that I want to do. I mean, this is... Van Gogh and Bacon did these paintings, which is called The Artist on His Way to Work. Mm. It's like, if you're an artist, then you're an artist. And you're an artist when you're at home, you're an artist when you work. So if you do a painting of yourself on your way to work, where the hell are you? And it's kind of an interesting dilemma. So, and I've got this idea to do a show, which is like, you know, with leaf-cutting ants. So it's like, I want to do like an 80-foot big tank with a stick in the middle with water, with food at one end and a home for the ants at the other end. And all day long they go up and down. It's called Work in Progress, and they go up and down, they get the food, they go back. And in the gallery, I want to have the song playing, hey-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work we go, with a shovel and a stick and a walking stick, hi-ho, 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 hi-ho.
But would there be worker ants?
No one said it was going to be easy.
Are ants easier to come by than sheep and things and sharks, don't you?
I want to do a unicorn in formaldehyde.
that will be interesting. Now, it's sort of a serious question. Now, if you're going to do these ants, will you research into the kind of ant that would be appropriate? I mean, you don't just go to a local nest of British ants.
I'll try and look after them, do you know what I mean? Because I hate killing things for art.
Oh, no, yes.
It's a hell of a lot easier to get ants than it is to get dwarves.
I can believe that. So, I mean, one of the points, I suppose, about some 20th century art is that it moved away from the finished framed object, either or indeed the finished sculpture, towards something that moved in time. And I know art intellectuals talk about this as a response to Bergson and the sort of philosophy of time and free will, and that art should represent the horizontal, the fact that it's in process rather than just a fixed, frozen thing like Keats's, you know, Grecian urn. And is that something that interests you? Because you've been most associated with death and the finish, and you're now interested at the moment in things moving.
People intellectualise art from the past, but it's, you know, let's have a laugh. Let's brighten people's lives up. My art's about life, really, not about death.
And one of your heroes, of course, is an exemplar of things being laughed at, and that's Yves Klein, isn't it? Tell us about his blue exhibition. You told me about it once, and I found that very amusing.
I think he did a thing where he invited people to an opening. There was no art there, and they were all drinking wine. And there was no art, and they couldn't believe it. And they went home, and then when they got home, they pissed, and everyone pissed blue. It was like a chemical you put into the into the wine,
which I'm sure tasted better than most wine does at art exhibitions. So, I mean, do you have a studio where you go as a painter might?
I have all kinds of things.
Yeah. Do you have one studio? I do have lots of kinds.
I have all kinds of things. No, I've got a studio. I'm buying a studio in Gloucestershire, but I don't think it works like that anymore. I mean, I've done a restaurant. I mean, you know, you do an installation, you do that. There's a point when art goes on the floor, and you know, sculptures go on the floor, paintings go on the wall, and at the end of the day, it's like an installation seems like a dumb word. It's like you do a restaurant, and it's like a great place for people to be. I mean, in the restaurant, people come up to me and they. It's fantastic when they come up to me and say, what's it about, to be able to say, shut up and eat your dinner.
Yes, I can imagine, which you can't say in our gallery. At least you've got the function going on behind.
Shut up and buy the painting.
I thought you'd stand in the National Gallery shouting, shut up and eat your dinner at people.
Well, they did that thing, didn't they, with the National, where they said it's a, you know, rather it's a nice museum with a great calf attached. A great calf with a rather nice museum attached.
Now, the poet of the great calf, of course, is Ian Dury, whose Geraldine from his latest album is one of my currently favourite songs. And his work in progress in the last few years has emerged in the form of this stunning new album, which is called Mr. Love Pants, for those of my generation for whom it is, frankly, impossible to separate first kisses, troubling thoughts and guilty stains from the sounds of Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick, Clever, Trevor and Bitheriki Dicky. The name of Ian Dury will always be holy. And here he is now, with some of his blockheads, to perform live for us The Passing Show.
Sweet.
were simple and naive. We wore our feelings on our sleeve. As we've gone jaded and corrupt, our manners guarded and abrupt. Oh, how we smile most readily whilst plowing on unsteadily. Now frowns are etched upon our face. We can no longer stand the pace. Although we got to go with a passing show, it doesn't ever mean we haven't made the scene. And what we think we know to what is really so is but a smithereen of what it might have been. Nothing ventured, nothing failed. When life itself can chart the course, then life's the product we endorse. When circumstances tell of death, we keep our counsel, save our breath. Although we got to go with a passing show, it doesn't ever mean we haven't made the scene. And what we think we know to what is really so is but a smithereen of what it might have boys and girls. As now we balk and hesitate, encumbrance comes to those who wait. But when we're torn from mortal coil, we leave behind a counterfoil. It's what we did and who we knew, and that's what makes the story true. Although we got to go with a passing show, it doesn't ever mean we haven't made the scene. And what we think we know to what is really so is about smithereen of what it might have been.
Johnny!
Oh, wonderful. Thank you very much, Ian Dury. Richard, perhaps you'll know, is there a name for that riff, that sort of da-da-da-da-da-da-da, sort of American boot camp thing, isn't it? Is that what it's...
Shaving a haircut, two bits.
Oh, is that what it is?
Or Bo Diddley.
Bo Diddley. It's a nice sound. Ian, I sound tacky coming straight in with this, but one can't help but ask the composer reasons to be cheerful. What you might think of a god who, not content with troubling your life with polio, then inflicts upon you the ravages of colonic cancer, which you've spoken about so wonderfully over the last few months.
I don't believe in God.
Have you ever, or have you stopped because of, you know, you've been rather shat upon?
I never had time to believe in God.
Too busy living?
Yeah.
No? Anybody on the table believe in God?
Yeah, I do.
If you want to hear now, punch his lights out.
Hey, but
I do.
I give you for that.
Every other day or so. But, your music is resolutely cheerful as a rule. I mean, no one could ever call you the Morrissey of London, or that style is not yours. Have you considered integrating your personal suffering into your music, if that's not too tough?
I don't usually write songs about me, so I usually write, like, portraits or observations. Sometimes I write about my dad or something, but I wouldn't write about... That song I just sang with the boys there is about friends of ours that have died too young. So it is about death, that one.
Yes.
But not related to me. I wrote that about 5 years ago.
I tend to find cheerful songs more moving than melancholy ones. I always cry at Officer Krupke in West Side Story rather than, One Hand, One Heart, for example. I don't know if you're the same. I find something about cheerfulness deeply moving.
I like that song, Krupke. Yeah. That's a great song.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. And now, this is the most pathetic question anyone can ever write a song, ask a songwriter, but I always do. And then, do you write your lyrics first?
Most of the time I do, but Chaz very often pushes a piece of music towards me, and I can't find a way of getting into it. I can't find my rhythm don't work with his, his assonances or whatever they're called. Quite often it's down to the way I talk, or the way I think, or the way I write, and then Chaz will
take syllables out.
Whatever rhythm in common.
Right.
Yeah. So I think it's usually because I write a doggerel, really, and Chaz can find a bit of freedom within it to make it pretty.
Well, it's brilliant to have you all here. Thanks very much, Nate. We'll stay for the conversation to come. Now we move on to John Sessions, pet of the smart set, darling of all persons of rank and tone. He's been tuning into heavenly regions where Catholic author, composer and polymath Anthony Burgess has finally been upgraded from purgatory to paradise class.
August 1998, heaven. 5 years of bliss and no denial so far of writing materials in my celestial incarceration. The ether Olivetti, which floats before me, still has greater quiddity than that promised by the lovely Sioux creature for my desert island. Did she envisage this, I ask myself, my just or unjust desert island? I still manage 2,500 words a day, and although seraphic phonemes have proved tougher by far than those of Yoruba, they've also proved that there's afterlife in the old dog yet. A preferred old dog, I should add, since on registration day I was told I would be honored by weekly audiences with him. A greater honor, I need hardly say, than any I'd received from the septic little isle far below. I awaited our first high-minded symposium with an almost frantic joy. What fireside chats, I wondered, might Lucifer be offering in the smoky servants' quarters? Dismissed servants, that is, who, having flobbed in the heavenly consomme, now bobbed in the fiery bisque. Not seeing Jack Priestley anywhere, I assumed correctly that he was down below. Him, understandably, not being able to abide fat Yorkshiremen who talk endlessly about English seaside resorts before the Great War. Jack would have taken this in his stride, of course, damnation, that is, looking on the bright side, seeing the vomiting sulfur as more of a colite glow, making eternal damnation oh so understandable to all. I dismissed the podgy, trans-Pennine populist from my mind and signed my name in deft Hokkaido Japanese. The polite young angel took my form and regarded it with radiant perplexity. I was just about to inquire if he'd prefer the Kyushu characters when Heisenberg and Einstein brushed past. Are you seeing him today, Albert? I overheard. Yes, Werner, we're playing dice. But don't tell anyone. Why weren't two Germans speaking in their native tongue? It seemed odd. Then Spengler told me that English or heaven speak was now the language recommended on the memos. With this, I inquired, because the speaking in many tongues was anathema. Spengler shook his head. No, he said, it was a very recent development. Billions of voices inquiring enthusiastically after him lulled me with a sort of interrogative Muzak of the spheres. Speaking of Muzak, one may hear a lot of hymns up here, but thankfully none written by the Wesley brothers. him didn't mind their sermons. He is, broadly speaking, tolerant of, you know, church's M.O.T. garage. He just hated their hymns. The Isley brothers, yes. The Wesley brothers, no. Him told me at our first meeting over a double espresso. That's when English music really started to go off, Antonio. I mean Anthony. I rhapsodized briefly on the glories of the English madrigal and then suggested that the dumbing of culture might provide as good a subject as any for our initial exchange. Him seemed to agree, but then suddenly whispered in flawless Santa Monican that he preferred it if I smoked elsewhere. Where, though? No sign anywhere for a smoker's room. Had him changed his mind? Would I be joining Jack Priestley in pipe-smoking torment? It seemed unlikely. Stavros Blofeld innuendo wasn't really him's style, but even I knew that eternal beatitude was worth more than a passing cloud, so I dropped my cheroot in the general direction of Cambridge University and again urged the question, is it all getting dumber, him? I ventured. Does cosmic unity really involve the death of diversity? Does man fulfill his destiny through exercising free will or through watching Free Willy and exercise? Him paused, deliberating on which accent to adopt, Yahweh being a bit of a Yarwood, if truth be told. Given his lust for lucidity, I wasn't surprised when he opted for my native Mancunian, the unmistakable tones of Coronation Street's Bill Tarmy issuing from his sacred lips. You got to see the big picture, lad. And I don't mean the one shown at the Gabriel Multiplex. No, but seriously. Once I'd done dinosaurs and them big elephants with the curly tusks, I started up all these little, you know, communities all over the place. Tigris, Euphrates, India, you know, all them other places. Had him, I wondered, mistaken me for a Sumatran blowpiper, someone hermetically sealed from the history of his planet. Surely he'd know that I would know all this. I elected to say nothing and let him continue. So I thought, Anthony, what a giggle it'll be when all these civilizations start swapping ideas. But after they'd swapped a few pots and bolts of silk, they just wanted to swap rocks. Then arrows the length of Cross Street with flames coming out of their arses. Pardon my French, I mean English. I was too clever for my own good, you know. I mean, I wasn't content with doing mortals. I did gods and prophets and sons of gods and all. I started them all off at different times like a relay race. Thought, oh, they'll have a laugh discovering how they'll all more or less saying the same thing, you know, get on with the bloke next door and see he's all right for a nail if the roof drops in. But I didn't think ahead. Had the option to. I got the software. Too excited, see? All knowing, all nothing. All born yesterday and wetter behind the ears than Macclesfield Baths. That was me, Hunt. Only hope that lot down there's got is if they all become the same and sing something simple like the Cliff Adams singers. And we're setting an example up here. As he broke into song, I was stunned by what I was hearing. The Lord of all was becoming the Lord of more. I paradoxically comforted both myself and him with the thought that the Indo-Pakistani nuclear race might have precipitated this hunger for homogeneity. He looked disconcertingly blank.
I got the idea way back, Hank. Can't remember if it was when I first heard that Roger Miller song about bobbies and bicycles or... No, that was it. That program filmed up in Port Merion. Oh, lovely part of Wales. Do you know it? Oh, what was it called? Oh, The Prisoner. That McGowan lad? Genius. And there's me thinking I'm clever. You know, he shows everyone all happy going round to them little golf trolleys. And then this bloke named after those cheap fags, Number Six, he keeps trying to stir things up. I thought, that's it. I'm not going to be perishing Number Six. People start making out everything's all complicated and I'll thump them. I will. I nearly mashed Peter Greenaway's fingers in an editing machine. I was so sick of all those duff films of his. Never mind Tom Stoppard, he'll start a war, you see if he don't. And if I'm honest, Anthony Smarty Pants, and I hope I am, all I can say about you is you're lucky you're here. With this, he informed me that the double espresso had suddenly made him sleepy and leant back with an expression less beatific, I must confess, than annoying. And all that was 5 years ago. Him and I continued to chat. He has a Joycean knowledge of Manchester's one-way systems, but then he will revert to old plot lines from Corrie, as he likes to call it. This loses me, which makes me, I suppose, a lost soul. Yet I persist. Up here, still the only one who does any real work, the only one prepared to think and speak in tongues, and as I look down through the bland bars of the clouds, so much less interesting from this side, I see that you've completed your dome. And this morning, an idle glance down at the Florida bushfires has got me wondering. Might Satan have sat through unpriestly Jack's account of the day war broke out once too often and be looking for a replacement, Scheherazade?
Well, Johnny, sensational.
Crikey.
Now, I believe you actually met Anthony Burgess, didn't you?
I did. I was delighted. I'm a big fan, as a lot of us are. And he came out with extraordinary things.
one of the technicians in the studio turned over to him and said, "Oh, excuse me, you can't smoke in here," because Anthony was smoking a cheroot, because he always did.
He said, "I don't see why not. Smoke rises. Redemption."
And the guy just looked at him blankly, and that was the end of that.
It is the absolutely unanswerable. He was, of course, famous for his extraordinary ability to quote in many languages, and he was perhaps one of the most self-consciously polymathic of our great writers. We talked earlier about my moment of rage at the use of the word respirateur. I'd hate to think what he would have thought of it. Those lucky enough to have heard the BBC's Rees lecture a couple of years ago entitled The Language Web will remember Professor Jean Aitchison, Rupert Murdoch Professor of Language and Communication at Oxford University, there's the title if ever there was one, and her admirable sense on the subject of such perennial Radio 4 shibboleths as grammar and mispronunciation. She's one of the leading writers and thinkers on linguistics and language theory today. Also here is Ian Sinclair, who writes verse and prose you could shave on, a poet and novelist in whom the linguistic past of Donne, Shakespeare, Dickens coexists with the language of Sandringham Road, Yardies, Estuary Lads and Soho Ponces, just as the architecture of different centuries coexists in the London he recreates so exquisitely. I want to broaden out from language and ignorance and so on, but it's as good a starting place as any. Jean Aitchison, if I can begin with you, you don't hold much of a brief for linguistic pedantry as such, do you?
No, I care enormously about people saying clearly what they want to say, and I find it a total waste of time when people sit around worrying about trivia. And I think it's a hangover from the army when people have to polish their buttons.
Yes, it is a kind of blankoing, isn't it, a verbal blanking. But, I mean, the counter-argument, I suppose, that one could direct in favour, if one can, of some sort of pedantry is, I think, Janet Daly wrote, and not that we always believe anything Janet Daly says, but that, in a sense, the rules, if they are rules, exist in order to free us, as rules often do, in order to free us to be more clear.
Oh, well, people confuse real rules, where you do have to have some kind of order in what you're saying, with these strange artificial ones, such as don't split infinitives. And in fact, you actually have to split infinitives in order to be clear. I mean, if you say something like, he asked them to kindly refrain from smoking, you have to put the kindly between to and refrain. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense at all. You try it in the other place.
Yes, you're absolutely right. No, I agree with that. I think that's true. But would you agree that people are less knowledgeable about such things, whether they're important or not, about what a preposition is, let alone whether to end a sentence with one or not?
Well, I don't think that's entirely true. I think people are knowledgeable in other ways. If you actually look at the writing that's going on nowadays, it's enormously fresh, and there are new paths being trodden in the way people write, and they don't have to know all these things about, you know, infinitives and adverbs and what's what, as long as they're saying things interestingly and clearly.
Yes, it's true, isn't it?
I disagree, I'm sorry.
Do you?
What are you trying to say?
Absolutely.
We'll come to you in a moment, Johnny, because I'm going to broaden this out. Right. And I'm sure there are lots of people listening who disagree. As I mentioned before, Radio 4 is perhaps the last refuge of the language pedant, talking of which I can offer you a joke. Who led the pedant's revolt? Which Tyler? Now, Ian Sinclair, I spoke earlier about, it's a sort of pet thing of mine, language and cities, you know. I often feel sorry for the French because of the Académie Française. It has made their language, to some extent, a bit like a Milton Keynes of a language. But do you, I mean, do you worry about ignorance? Do you think young people are more ignorant? Does that make sense as a phrase?
I kind of live in ignorance. Ignorance is the substance that I swim through. I mean, I kind of aqua lung through ignorance perpetually. I know that I don't know anything, and I know there's this kind of enormous plane of darkness around us.
And isn't that the hook? Isn't what makes people angry, I suspect what makes John angry, and a lot of listeners, is that people not only don't know that they're ignorant, they don't care. They don't have an impulse or a curiosity that drives them to know about anything. If it's not something they believe they're interested in, it washes over them without interest. Jean,
I was going to say, Ian's writing is the sort of thing that people who don't know about formal language but write really, really vividly are what we want. So, I mean, he talks about the Stoke Newington Road, if you know it, which stretches onwards like the rubberneck of a chicken. Now, that's absolutely marvellous. You don't have to know about grammar to do that. And he's got a number of other things, like the tarmac was bubbling like black cheese. Now, isn't that marvellous? Because you spend time working out, is this black? Is the cheese black or is it the tarmac black? And you get exactly what's happening.
That's lovely,
so
but with respect, you remind me of my English master when I was very, very small, first introducing me to a poem and making it sort of alive for me in the way schoolmasters do. And see, isn't Ted Hughes clever? Because he really, you know, because you can think of that, can't you? And that's lovely. But, you know...
You should see the cheese at the bottom of the
black cheese.
I don't mean to diss your image, which is a lovely one, and absolutely right. And, of course, poets and writers can write beautifully. You don't have to know anything about... You don't have to know whether bubblings are present parts of Bull or Gerund. It doesn't matter, obviously. But that's not precisely what we're talking about, is it? It's
I don't mind puffs as long as we don't try it on with me.
That's probably also not what we're talking about, but I think Damon has always drags us down to the kind of reality that we want to inhabit.
What does this mean,
which it, I think it's short for disrespect and is drawn from the argo
the
of North America.
The only person who can use dis and gerund in the same sentence.
What about dis in there? Oh,
dis is also, of course, a Greek mythological word for hell. I was going to sort of make that point, really. I've said Greek mythology now. The last 200 or 300 years, certainly, a certain kind of educated person could take as a common frame of reference things like Greek mythology, things like the common history of our own nation, and so on. Nowadays, for all kinds of reasons, some of them political, we regard world culture as the frame of reference from which we draw, but this gets into arguments too. I don't know if you heard of Saul Bellow's big to-do with the academic establishment in America, where he was accused of being Westernist, and he said, well, where is... the Proust of Papua New Guinea, where is the Shakespeare of Nigeria? Show them to me, I want to read them. And this was regarded as snobbish and outrageous.
Oh, I can tell you the Proust of Papua New Guinea. I've got some marvellous poems written in Top Pigeon, which nobody knows. The BBC should pick up on it, perhaps.
Well, that's a very fair point, absolutely. I mean, these things probably do abound, and perhaps we're being insular in our own culture and so on. But if we believe that, oh, they write beautifully, this is wonderful, you don't have to know the history, the background, the mechanisms of language or of culture, or indeed of science. I mean, one shouldn't stick exactly just to poetry and language. Is one losing out? And I'm being half devil's avocado here and half speaking from my own gut, which is one that does... for some odd reason, perhaps it's a nerdishness in me, relish things like the texture of language and the knowledge of what drives it and what words grammarians have given to things, not that they are absolute and real. We all know that the word stone is not a stone, nor
isn't
is it a noun.
Isn't it the holes between things which is exciting? It's like, I mean, I said, what are you trying to say? I mean, I did a sculpture called Nothing is a Problem for Me. And it's like you talk about clarity, but nothing is a problem for me is I have no problems, and the facts of nothing causes me problems.
Yes.
It's like what you're trying to say.
I think, yes. I mean, in that sense, I suppose it's a bit like architecture, isn't it? Is architecture space punctuated by bits of stone, or is it stone punctuated by bits of space? Johnny, you look anxious to say
something. No, the point I was going to say, I mean, an extreme example of what Gene has been talking about, where the artist has the license to just run riot, either through metaphor or whatever, but more pointedly through grammatical construction, is The Old Woman in As They Lay Dying by William Faulkner, who said, words never mean what they're trying to say at, which is a complete extraordinary change of language. But the same book uses as an image Claudius's speech in Hamlet, which says, my words fly upwards, my thoughts remain below, words without thoughts never get to heaven go. I'm slightly adapting that. But what is absolutely crucial in my objection to what you believe in, Gene, is that a very basic structure like participles and tenses must be observed. Not must be observed through some sort of Académie Française thing.
But
so you know exactly where you are in time. In time in what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, you need to know where you are in time.
Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is you naturally observe them.
No, you don't. No, people can, for example, if I may, with respect, if most people, I think, do need to know, for example, the difference between the past and the pluperfect. Or the perfect past.
They don't need to know it's called the pluperfect.
They don't need to know that at all. They don't even need to be in a mortarboard to say that. They do need to know and be able to express succinctly. And we're not talking about art, artistic expression, but being able to communicate in business and daily working life the difference between the immediate past and the past before the past.
Oh, sure.
And to be able to constantly know.
J.G. Ballard says the first casualty of World War II was the past.
You're dead right.
You should come to Kettering, John.
Can we get back to jokes?
Well, I just want to say, this is absolutely true. In Kettering, there's an expression,
Kettering.
I shall have been yesterday, which means I shall have to been yesterday, which means I went yesterday. How I shall have to been yesterday came about, I don't know, but it makes perfect sense to people in Kettering.
Yes. But if we all had to write letters to all our to the gas board and everybody around Britain in the Kettering dialect, we'd be in a very...
Yes, With respect, and this is a whole subject in itself, obviously, but, I suppose I really wanted just to find out if people felt any kind of sense that we know less than our forefathers about things that matter. And know more about things that don't matter. Because I sense that a lot of people believe that. And I'm not sure whether I believe it or not. Some Tuesdays I do, Wednesdays I don't. I mean, I'm that insecure.
I think that's very interesting, Stephen. I mean, I work at Radio 3 normally, and there's been a lot of criticism of Radio 3 lately about dumbing down, da-da-da. I was talking to a historian of the station. He was saying that way back in the 1950s, when the third programme was at its height, people said exactly the same thing then, in exactly the same way, and about exactly the same sorts of things. I think that people always imagine that, you know, it's very easy to throw your arms up and go, and o tempura, depending on whether you're eating sushi.
Tempura is Greek food, exactly. Yeah, well, Japanese food.
But I think that is just a sort of, it's a habit that happens. Yeah. I think, you know, if you think about it more critically.
It's a kind of primal curse of humanity to believe that our children are more ignorant than us.
I think it's a way of insuring yourself against the threat of the coming generation.
That's all true. That's absolutely true. Coleridge was apparently the last man to have been able to read everything.
Yeah.
Knowing these terms of reference, it's suggesting that if you know how your language works, and I do stress the standard language, and I understand that, and I'm from Scotland and all the rest of it, you can then go and expand. You can break the rules. You can tie them in knots. You can do everything.
You can do that without knowing the formal... First of all, yes, of course, I teach the formal vocabulary if you want to analyse language, but what I'm saying is that sensitive people, writers, can go ahead and break new ground, and you don't have to know these rules.
And absolutely. Yeah. I mean, things like that, and then you talk about cheesy road surfaces. Yes. Do you know what I mean?
It's absolutely. That's the beauty of it. I mean, an obvious thing to hear, to bring in Ian Dury and Richard, because an obvious comparison might be music. Now, you don't need to know the rudiment. Do you know what a diminished seventh is, Ian Dury, for example?
I'd know one if I was sitting on one.
Exactly. But
you
I'm
have
sure
it, I'll play it.
I'm sure you may well have employed one from time to time, or a Tiesto Picardy, or any other thing, which is a sort of grammarian equivalent. I remember a George Bernard Shaw piece about music criticism, in which he wrote a review, as it were, as current music critics did in his day, of Hamlet's famous soliloquy, saying the soliloquy begins with an expression of the verb of existence placed in its infinitive form, followed by the conjunction of alternative or. So we are faced with the initial subject to be, or there is then a chiasmic negativization of this not to be, in which the subject is expressed in it. And he's saying that is how music critics talk about music. It's absurd when you apply it to verse. And I think musicians tend to suffer that more because it seems to be a mathematical quantity more than language.
Well, I think something interesting there. I mean, I'm in a position that I started out as a classical musician and then actually earned my living as a pop musician, working in kind of popular music. And in a way, it's two different kinds of jobs. I do know what a diminished seventh is, but if I'm actually playing a diminished seventh in a piece on a record on stage or something, I'm not thinking this is a diminished seventh. And this relates to the language we were talking about earlier, because at university I studied Greek, and so I know what a nominative is, I know what a participle is. But does that mean anything to me? Does that actually engage with the way I'm talking now, the way I write when I'm writing in English? No, I don't think it does. In a way, it's a different species of knowledge.
That's why you've been able to say what you've just been able to say.
Comes in as you're collaborating.
Come on, you didn't know.
I didn't think so.
If you're a musician, well, you're working with other musicians.
It would have taken Richard 5 minutes to have
said that. We just let Ian Dury say, sorry.
If a diminished seventh is something that you're all going to share across there.
Yeah.
Then they're going to need to know what it is.
Absolutely. So it's practical, essentially. Yeah.
You know, we're inventing the future. You know, it's like, you know, words are like a plaything. It's like what you're trying to say.
That's your refrain.
And I don't know. You look for clarity, but I mean, I don't think it's not clear. The holes between things are like...
Yeah, the holes between. Johnny, you were...
Yeah, but I was going to say, when do you come in and say, this is right, or this... Not this is right, this will enable you to get the things that are going on in your head out to the outside world if you say... I did this rather than I done this. It will enable you then to express the tense before that.
Well, I think
it's a different texture. I've done this. It's got a different.
Let's turn this now towards music.
What about when you write? When you write,
you use whichever is appropriate. You use both.
We're going to have to carry this on in the green room because it can go on forever, and I'm sure the boys and girls at home will be joining in with you as well. But I'm going to turn to Richard Coles now, who has moved swiftly and yet gracefully across to the BBC piano, squatting in the corner of Studio 6A like an old hippopotamus. The piano, that is, not Richard. Do you think, in the field of music, Richard, that the music lover who knows more about Saint-Saëns, say, than the All Saints, knows more, per se, about music?
Well, I'm pretty much of the view that the only distinction worth making about any work of art is it good or is it bad? High culture, low culture, who gives a fig? And there's plenty of evidence to suggest that the line drawn by the gatekeepers of high culture is an arbitrary one. For example, in music, the relations between what we hear in the concert hall and what we hear down the drinker can be astonishingly blurred. Puccini, near the end of his life, made sketches for an opera, La Marcia Lambetta, which have puzzled musicologists ever since. What were his sources? Well, this is the score for the big tenor aria planned for Act Two, in which Tommaso tells his beloved Paulina that although he is poor, come what may, he will accompany her on life's path. The sketches of the libretto by Arturo Daschi, roughly translated, go, whenever the sunset encrimsons the sky, I will be found at your side with tutta mia famiglia, following the perambulatory traditions of the district. Goes something like this. It wasn't only Puccini who was the only composer to find inspiration in the vernacular musics of Europe. Brahms, in Vienna in the 1880s, sketched this little-known waltz, inspired, it was thought, by a washerwoman's song of proletarian solidarity with the women folk of the Viennese working class. Still with Brahms, famous as a collector and interpreter of folk material, a little-known A minor Hungarian dance has yielded some tantalizing clues as to its origins. Now, it was thought that this melody was played beside the banks of the Danube by travelling peoples from around the middle of the 16th century. My research suggests something quite different. Have it. Proof that what was today played in the Albert Hall may well have originated in the Queen Vic. Culture, Stephen, it's a salad. Thank you.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you very much. That last one reminds me of another joke. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
M-A-B, it's a big horse.
M-A-B, it's a big horse who?
M-A-B, it's a big horse. I'm an Andonad. Thank you very much indeed. Well, we've tried to cover ignorance and philistinism and goodness knows what else. Thank you. We'll more jokes next week, perhaps. But now, perhaps the only thing I do know with any certainty is that we've come to the end of our time here. An almost unbearable pall of melancholy settles over me as I say a very necessary but heartfelt and grateful thank you to Damien Hirst, Ian Sinclair, Professor Dean Acheson and Ian Dury. Richard Coles will be with us again, as next and every week will be the impossible splendid John Sessions. I've had fun, I hope you have too, and can find time to join us next week at the same time. Goodbye.